Blog Talk Radio.
Online, on air.
Politics on the Navajo Nation.
Politics on the Navajo Nation.
Hey, my name is Dylan. You are listening to Internet Radio Politics on the Navajo Nation. To be our guest, call
347-989-0048. I appreciate everybody dialing in this evening. And again, you are listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, the world voice of Navajo politics. This evening, we had several things that we wanted to discuss. And so far, I have not gotten a call from our guest, which is supposed to be Mr. Mike Halona from the Navajo Nation, to talk about the Navajo Nation land issue and land, whatever that is, that was taking place over in the Twin Arrows Casino. So I will wait for them and see what happens. But in the meantime, we're waiting for Marley Shabala to give us her status of the Navajo Nation. And then also at 7:30, we are going to be getting a call from Mr. Bill Donovan to do his news flash. It will be interesting to see what was going on. And I understand here's some things that we ought to be thinking about in the meantime, and that is that the special prosecutor, I guess, has just announced that they are not going to pursue with any charges, or they're going to prosecute former President Dr. Joe Shirley Jr. And that's just for your information. And also, the Navajo Nation political season is also coming up. So right now, I'm not sure how many people out there, how many of you know. Maybe you can call in and give us what the latest, how many candidates there are, how many people have registered, and when exactly the registration starts and when it ends, those sorts of things. I don't even know. At least I know about maybe four or five people. And also things that are on my mind that I want to address this week, and Shady Denen Shiro Aro H. Ishikin, so I Adansis case. Ako Ajahar Shina Shan, the Quit of Salt Lake City, or wherever it is that I live, A. Ara Eight Adnen Shle Aro Chapej, A. Ara Bishna Ultra. And I feel like I'm part of the Navajo Nation political system. I'm part of the Navajo. Adanashtal, Shibijido, Shayajido, Shikaya te. Quen hananin za, Shikoin, Randon Kaya. Quenada Honils and the Shikno Aro, you go around to the community. Up to Tesla's dear, a hair lana quen hananin za, Shitno. A co abin in naturally, Hutoi Hainshnen. A co vetoe, Ajoe, Arona Kinantli, go Ajin Hashta. Ako shishito de do doit asai with o dances kista. The quigo shi hashin zagodne koi begarden da ti. Sainle Washington State, Massachusetts, Edo Dal, Florida, California, Nebraska, da are are na sha. Da no da da had net said koda inle Facebook da chin so. Ako jo eishin lo, ada lo bini naan, hud loo shin da kai. Lai naan nishi kain da kai, lai ul kai kain da kai. Ahud o, ako di ada dne, Navajo Nation de, ne kera hat ini. Ako jo ada et anhi, nihi keidan lini dao lion hi madon hi je, bishkada shi je, nihi che, nihi naladan lini. Nihi masandan lini. Nihi sna ash. Chitta. The kui wishi hut o geda hi diitne. Ako e are hut o in khan si kis. Yat e a chehet lane. Nihi tat no si yajin chet a we. Nihi tat no nihi chi yat hitle. Ako are nahi kao ha si ko nchanda atasle. Si yada atasle. Ko e hut e. Coin hut o e quain run, hut o e gade. Coin hit hold zish, and hit it no. Ako, din hikwarin de craigi. Ado sudden, Hashin zago, stohut o, all of you. All of those people who are off somewhere, they were there for a reason. And here's the thing, and I'm going to say this. It really bothers me that the people who live on the Navajo Nation, ahut o ada nche ada ndakai, nche kwanda haishin bin ya ada hut o in dakai, ada hut o Navajo Nation, I'm a part of the Navajo Nation that doh nile haishin bin ya ada ndakai, doh ne kwadin han, nahan nadaho kata, dan hitat no. Well, here's the thing. Shikato shitane, Hashin zao di de koe, di de akusilzi. Kureba nan hoshka. Di et aro hat nendole. Hala di kuden de krebini nane, hut oe jo et an hi, nhen hi de di. Kudo heda hut o ni hikiji yast hidole. Ni hikiji sadis adole. Edo bini yeda. Clay old cup in Yakon, the year with the inost cut up at the no agent with a scholarship by Dalia. Yan at Oden, not agent to die in this clay. Now, if there is a way for these people to get back to the Navajo Nation and they have a job open, there was a place for them to establish their livelihood, to be able to expend their expertise on the Navajo Nation, well, certainly they would be back. But I'm hearing just totally the opposite story. I got a really good job over here. I'm not going back. And besides, when I do go back, my resume is not even recognized. And the list goes on and on. And these are the unique stories. And there are other cases where there are specifically economic reasons. There are reasons that are related so personal that nobody has the right to go in there and to place judgment on people who, whoever and where they may reside, whatever reason that they're out there. In my case, certainly I could be down there. In my case, certainly I would be down there. But you don't know what the dynamics of my reasons that I'm here. I was raised by traditional grandparents. I was raised in a hogan, the bebekate na shell, edo thou sheet be gushy. I was out there, shanala ada, shanala ada nick at a do yaskit and or with a gun at a do yaskit and a coho. Tina bons be yoe, I don't go, ain't he God? Those were our transportation. I believe, and I can honestly say at the time, it was an embarrassment to me to be able to be riding in a horse-drawn wagon. But you know what? Having fast-forwarded to now, I'm proud that I experienced that. I'm proud that I was able to live what I consider the ultimate true traditional way. My grandparents were the last one in the Sanasti area to be in a horse-drawn wagon. Well, you know, those are my experiences and the reasons why that they had advocated me. And it's not just me. These are similar stories. Foster family. Chapter House Bains Nitoli, Navajo Nation Bains Nitoli, Hashin Zada, Arodida, Nlini, Ke, E. Arjadan, to the Bayo Nathan, then hit that noe conte. If there was any other reasons why that we could go home, well, we would certainly be home. But now, the dynamics of the Navajo Nation political system and the relationships on the Navajo Nation, it doesn't matter where the Navajo is. A Navajo is. They're still Navajo. They still have a clan system. They still have the voting right and all of those. So for anybody to place judgment on people, A Arendal Kahitnini, Kadidodli, Arodato, Nene, Eko, we're not urban Navajos. We don't view ourselves that way. We're not considered as off-reservation Navajos. We consider ourselves to be Dene Tlini Bilash. We're one and the same. And that's all I want to say about that. Shot Nisa Forrest Gump. The other thing, too, that's very interesting, which is the Olympics is starting tomorrow night. I wrote on my Facebook about the 2002 Winter Olympics. And the bottom line in reference to that situation was that we had a tremendous opportunity for the Native Americans to get involved in the Olympics here in Salt Lake City back in 2002. I was involved right up front working with all of the delegation to bring the Olympics to Salt Lake City and in the process getting the Native American aspect of the Olympics identity. We actually also put products, merchandising, exhibits, opening, closing ceremony, had a full program. In the end, through the process, we got involved with the Utah State Government, Utah Division of Indian Affairs, and convinced them to help us to get involved, that here's a private venture, that we are going to try to get the Native American involved in every aspect of the Olympic Games. Well, they stole their idea, ran forward with it, and basically the Navajo Nation lost about $3 to $4 million, and I believe other tribes also lost. The Northern Tribe from Fort Duchesne also lost. And most of all the Native Americans who participated, maybe except for Robbie Robertson, who was the opening act in the Olympics, maybe he's the only one that got paid. Other than that, everybody just donated. And so it was a very disappointing thing for me. And I will continually to say this. A Native government or any government ought to allow and to support the private sector. People have dreams and they have these wonderful idea entrepreneurship that they ought to identify, support, and facilitating basically means allowing their paper processes, their business licensing, their every requirement and protocol that goes into getting a business started, including even a legislation to recognize these private ventures. And then the bottom line, and then the last thing is to provide financing. Yes, there's a risk there. What bank in the United States or the world doesn't face the risk of losing money? But that doesn't stop them. It keeps them driving, and that's the same thing that ought to happen here. And so it's quite interesting that that we could have had that possibility, that the Native Americans, if we could have only united, brought our resources together, and had the tribes were never meant to be left out of the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympic Games, but instead they force under the false pretenses, talk to the Salt Lake City Organizing Committee and as well as the state of Utah, threatening them that, hey, you know what? This is, if you're going to do anything with the Native Americans, it must be done with the tribes because there's sovereignty issues. And I said all along, sovereignty ends at the borders of every reservation. Out here, we're welcome to do whatever possible. But so years later, I've had the tribes coming back to me in various different places, including council delegates, saying, hey, Cal, we should have followed your lead. We could have succeeded in this thing and not lost $3 to $4 million in the process. And if we united, the Native Americans could have been the top dog in terms of having a one organization who could be the catalyst to sell the Native American merchandising, to sell the talents and the skills of the Native Americans here in Utah and throughout the world, all the way up into Canada with the First Nations as well. And we could have put the Olympics in a position where they could have only been, they could only go to one place, one-stop shop, and that's this organization that I tried to present. But so I guess in the end, it goes to show that government ought to stay doing their government thing and the private sector and to support the private sector. So there's all these things that we ought to be thinking about. And it's not, it just doesn't happen with the Navajo Nation. It happens in most of every tribe that I've been affiliated, I've been doing business for the past 27 years. So it's a quite interesting dynamics. And so I appreciate you listening. If you have any questions out there, you're welcome to call in at 347-989-0048. So I wanted to get those out there. And if you have any questions, you're welcome to email me, calnezdesign@gmail.com, calnezdesign@gmail.com. Or you can call me on my cell phone, which is my business line, which is 801-688-9297. So I thank you. I thank the listening audience. I thank the people who participate in Facebook. Thank you for being a friend. and always, because I think what we're doing is the most wonderful thing. We need to continue to address these issues. We need to continue to talk about these issues. And we have, what, about 9 months away, or even less, for until our Navajo Nation tribal elections take place. So having said that, again, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. Telephone number here is 347-989-0048. And forgive me, I've got a little bit of the dreaded gumboo that's been going around, so my voice probably feels a little interesting. So we have with us Ms. Marley Shabala. Hey, Marley, how are you?
Oh, yeah, to A, Cal, and to every one of your listeners out there. And I'm doing really good. I've been very busy, so that's really good.
That is really good that you're doing really good. I love it.
And the council just finished up their winter session. And just to let people know, a little background, the Navajo Council has to meet by law 4 times a year. And so this was, the winter session is one of those mandated council sessions. And it's usually for 5 days, but they haven't actually, for a while now, they haven't been going the 5 days since they become 24, having gone from 88 to 24. And so they finished up on Thursday, and I think some of the more controversial resolutions or legislation that went to the council, I talked about last week, which was the removal of Speaker Nave, and they didn't get the 16 votes needed, but if it only required a majority vote, Speaker Nave would have been removed because it was 12 in favor and 11 opposed. And the next legislation that created a lot of debate was appointing a new speaker. Some strategizing going on because that legislation only needed a majority vote, and the council obviously would have appointed a new delegate, but there's just a lot of maneuvering on the council floor with the council rules and policies, which is Navajo law. And sometimes individuals who are sitting there watching it, and if they're not familiar with the council rules and conduct and law, they kind of get lost in it and think that the council is being too technical. But if you understand it, you understand that there was a lot of maneuvering, and in the end, it's questionable whether or not the council or Speaker Pro Tem Edmund Yazzie legally removed that legislation from the council agenda. And he ruled that it was out of order, the legislation to appoint a new speaker.
You know, reading that, Marley. You know, I was reading on your posting on your website, which, by the way, was what's the name of the website, Marley?
Oh, it's now called Marley Shabala's Notebook. So you just Google my name, it'll pop right up.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. I was reading on those pages. You know, it seemed to me that while this debate, I mean, it started out, you know, here we have an issue, and that was, you know, that they said, okay, this person must be in good standing because he works at the pleasure of the council. And so the legislation started and eventually made it to Nabikeyati. To me, Nabikeyati is kind of the IGR of the old days, the Intergovernmental Relations, which was the chairman from each. Yeah. And so the word Nabikeyati is really what I think it's supposed to be, and that is that here is an issue, And Nabagiyati is, we are going to talk about this or an issue to be discussed and dissected in every detail. And so whatever the recommendation that happens there is, they're either in favor or against. So it kind of gives the ideology whether or not this particular legislation is going to move forward. But then it gets moved to the council. And on the council floor, the discussion was quite interesting. It was not very much of a discussion, but more, for the lack of a better term, Marley, was a revival. what do you think?
It was. There was on both of those legislations, the one to remove Speaker Menezes and then this one to appoint and a speaker to serve out Speaker Menezes' term. The delegates that were opposing both legislation, and therefore supporters of Speaker Menezes, they weren't talking about the criminal charges. They didn't address good standing. They addressed other issues that what you're talking about, which was, you know, they started quoting scriptures from the Bible. And people in the audience were openly laughing. But obviously that didn't seem to bother the council, because they continued on in that with their biblical rhetoric. Instead of addressing the issues which are in the fundamental law, and it's called the Fundamental Laws of the Diné, and it deals with ethics. People, I don't know, tend to forget that we as Diné people, we've always had our government, and this government that is in place right now was put in place by the federal government as a way for contracts to be made with the oil and gas companies that came to the Navajo Reservation and wanted to exploit those resources up in the Shiprock area. And this fundamental law of the Diné and our government, it was very fair, because it recognized the voices of the people. And when you talk about voices of the people, it recognized who we recognized at that time, and some of us still do, which is the ones, you know, the birds, the insects, water, air, fire, all of those we understood were just as alive as we are. We had not lost that. We had not disconnected ourselves from that teaching. Some have and some haven't by now. But those teachings are still there, and it's part of Navajo law. And some of the delegates tried to address it, and their voices are pretty much drowned out. And it resulted in a lot of confusion. And what you were first talking about regarding, it's basically we've started discriminating against each other as Diné people. And within the Diné fundamental law, you don't do that. And you don't, some of us have become accepting of these man-made walls, boundaries, state lines,
right,
reservation borders. We never had that. And we traveled. I mean, we traveled all over the place before 1492.
Certainly.
And And when one of us left, we didn't treat that individual as no longer a part of us. That's what the net fundamental law is about. And we're all related. You continue to be related. And there's, that's why we introduce ourselves the way we do, is
certainly
to understand that relationship and how you're supposed to treat each other, and that's what you were talking about. And yet we become assimilated, you know, acculturated in our thinking, and that's not the way we think. Those aren't the fundamentals, the nail laws. And it even went into the discussion that was for a referendum for the people to vote on recognizing that they are the governing body and that the council is not the governing body. And that legislation was sponsored by Council Delegate Jonathan Ned. And he was asked, and I was in a meeting before the council session, and he was asked by Council Delegate Catherine Benally if he was sponsoring that legislation to be popular. And, I was floored at that question, that another council delegate would ask another council delegate, is this why you're sponsoring legislation? And yet that legislation came from the people, so he was doing his duty by bringing it forward. And he'd been trying to bring it to the council since 2012. And that idea from the people started back in 2009.
Yeah. Marty, can you hold that thought?
Sure.
I want to go more into this whole thing that you're talking about the removal, and also about the new the appointing of the new speaker, also about the this power. And I want to kind of go back in time, but I've got one more fellow that I need to bring online, and I think you know who he is, and so I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll get right back with you here. Okay. Time goes on, and you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, the world voice of Navajo politics. And right now, we have the one and only Nhadanda, Mr. Bill Donovan. Bill, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Cal.
Okay.
Former Navajo Nation President Bill Shirley Jr. is able to be.
Oh, he's Bill. You're live with us right now. Hello.
Hello, this is Bill Donovan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, you're on air, live
on
and
air.
Being recorded.
Okay. Thank you. Former Navajo Nation President Joe Shirley Jr. is able to breathe a lot easier today. For the past 4 years, he has been under a cloud of suspicion because of allegations that he somehow benefited personally from deals that the tribe made with OnSAT and BCDS, companies that later were judged to have taken financial advantage of the Navajo tribe. On Tuesday, Shirley's attorney issued a press release saying that the tribe's special prosecutors have decided to drop all charges against him. The special prosecutors said Shirley cooperated with them, answering all their questions. So for him, the ordeal is over. But for some 45 former and current members of the tribal council, it's still not over. And the special prosecutors are now winding down their investigation. We expect to see a burst of decisions within the next 2 or 3 months, as special prosecutors decide which cases to take to court and which ones to settle. There are still some cases involving only a couple of $1,000s, and most of those will probably end up at settlement. but there are also some cases involving tens of thousands of dollars, and even one that is more than $250,000. There was a lot going on behind the scenes, and much of that centers around the upcoming elections. Navajo Nation Speaker Johnny Nez in December said he thought that as many as 11 members of the current council would not be running for re-election. At the time, people thought that his prediction was due to his belief that a lot of members of the council were getting burned out because of their workload. But there is another factor. 11 members of the council are still under investigation for illegally making deals to get money from this discretionary fund for their relatives. All of these 11 are eligible for deferred comp, money that is added to their salary every month, which comes to them only when their terms are over. To understand what this means, let's look at one case, the one against the council delegate from Two Great Hills in Red Valley area. The special prosecutors say Tom took advantage of loopholes in the discretionary fund process. They have charged him with conspiracy involving $279,000 in discretionary funds. Tom is still on the council, and if he comes to trial before next January and loses, he will face the possibility of the tribe confiscating all of his deferred comp, which is expected to be more than $100,000. If he can stall the investigation, or if he resigns before a hearing, he can get the tribe to release to him all of his deferred comp. Then, if he is found guilty, he will have to set up a restitution plan with the tribe, and these plans have in the past required a payment of between $100 and $150 a month. Under those conditions, it would take Tom more than 100 years to pay the $279,000 back. But he will wind up with his deferred comp, which would then be his to spend as he wants. And that $279,000 debt, the good thing about that is that Navajo Nation never adds interest, so there's no monetary penalty for paying late. So that is what many people think is happening with those members of the council who are still being faced with investigations. Wait until they get their deferred comp before having to deal with the charges against them. I'm Bill Donovan, and that was a news flash from the reservation.
I love it. Thank you very much, Mr. Bill Donovan.
Thank you, Cal.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next week. Wow. Very, very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Bill Donovan. He always adds a different dimension to this whole thought process, and I do appreciate that. And he is a Navajo Times reporter. I think he's with the Gallup Independent also. And again, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. Telephone number here is 347-989-0048. You're welcome to call in, and we are the world voice on Navajo politics. Well, thanks for holding, Marley. We have Ms. Marley Sabala with Marley's report. Did you say what? I'm sorry. Marley's notebook.
Marley Sabala's notebook.
Marley Sabala's notebook. So,
remembered.
Yeah, that's on your. So what did you think about that?
Well, the press release came from a former President Shirley's attorney, and Bill should have contacted the special prosecutors to verify that, and that's what happened anyway, because the special prosecutors did confirm that they had filed for the dismissal of charges against former President Shirley. And but those charges technically have not been dismissed until the judge signs that order. It's like, you know, any kind of legal action against anyone. Until the court accepts it, then it's actually happened. So technically, President Shirley is still facing charges until the motion to dismiss by the special prosecutors has been approved by the Window Rock District Court.
Oh, I see. Wow. Well, which brings up a very interesting point, Marley. I've said all along, here's kind of for those people who are really just kind of engaging themselves in this Navajo politics. Of course, you've been in this thing, the Navajo Nation government, for how long now, Marley?
Geez, it must be it's over 28 years, I know.
Yeah, 28 years that you've been. And so you were right there in the midst of the Window Rock riots. You were right there when they put those monster boulders right there in front of the entrance to the council chambers or the parking lot. And so having seen all of that, you know, but the history of this discretionary fund, which I find has been very interesting, you've got several different players. You have the Navajo Nation executive branch. You have the legislative, you have the judicial, and then there's also the Office of Attorney General, and he works under the pleasure of the president. And then you have the special prosecutor. Originally, when this whole discretionary thing started, it's interesting to me, and I want to get your feedback on this, who hired who, and whose money was used to hire the special prosecutor to go identify the monies that are supposedly have been misused, and where's that money going to be put back, and whether it's not going to be paid. But then all of a sudden, originally it was all tied into this power struggle between the legislative and the executive. And so that's why they were reducing 88, you know, all of that. But all in all, the Navajo Nation hired an outside person called a special prosecutor. And now it's been how many years now? 4 years. And so where do you think their role fits? And really, there's so many questions. I don't know, Marley, what do you think about the role of the special prosecutor? They seem to have kind of gotten mix of things, kind of lost in the mix of all of this. We're over here fighting amongst each other, saying so and so and so. But the special prosecutor over here, whatever they say, everybody jumps at that. Now, where is this sovereignty going to go? Can you kind of talk about that? What's your thoughts on that?
The special prosecutor, there was no law actually for a special prosecutor until Chairman Peter McDonald was federally investigated, and it was found that there were some serious federal charges. And it was at that point, and then you had the land swap, Big Boquias, and for some of the listeners who aren't familiar with that, President or Chairman McDonald took to the council a land purchase, the Big Boquias, and within days of bringing that to the council, the people who were selling the land increased it by about $15 million or $20 million. And the news media was able to get documents that showed that the initial price you have to have someone look at the land and say, yes, it's worth that much, and no, this is how much it really is. And one of the documents that came out showed that the what was being offered and being pushed by then Chairman McDonald was I'd say about maybe double the price. And then it was found out that there was a deal that was being made with some non-Indians. And so all of that came out eventually in the tribal court and then in federal court. And when Chairman McDonald went to court, he asked for a jury, and there were Navajo people on that jury, and they found him guilty. And so he went to tribal prison and then federal prison, but then they allowed him to serve the tribal sentence concurrently with the federal charges. But that's where a special prosecutor had to be brought in, and people don't understand that at that time, you didn't have a clear-cut executive branch, which is headed by the president, or it would have been the chairman, and then you have the legislative branch, which is headed by the speaker, and then the judicial branch, which is headed by the Supreme Court Chief Justice. And all those three branches are on equal footing. But at the time that this was happening with the investigation, with the federal investigation against Chairman McDonald, over the years, Chairman McDonald had been able to get the council to delegate their powers to him, which allowed him to preside over the council, which would be as if President Obama would be presiding over Congress. And some people would think, well, what's wrong with that? It's because you then begin having these overlapping powers, and you have one individual that has holds a lot of that power. In this case, it was Chairman McDonald. And so he was able to make political appointments. And when you have a political appointment, that individual serves at the pleasure of whoever appoints them politically. And because they're serving at the pleasure of that individual and they are political appointees, they could be fired for any reason. They don't even have to be given a reason. Chairman McDonald could walk into the Attorney General's office and tell the Attorney General, you're fired, and that's it. The Attorney General would have to pack up and leave. There would be no legal recourse. Unlike with some tribal employees who are unfairly fired, they can go to the Labor Commission and have a hearing and even eventually go to the court if they want to appeal the Labor Commission's decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a huge amount of power within the chairmanship, even over the council. And so the prosecutor's office is under the Attorney General. The Attorney General heads the Department of Justice. So when the federal prosecution was occurring and all of these charges were coming before the council, and they wanted to question Chairman McDonald, he was pretty much able to just, you know, shut it off. He wouldn't call on those individuals. He had complete control over the council. He sat there. He could call on whoever he wanted, whoever he didn't want. He was the only one that brought legislation. He was the one that appointed the committees. He appointed the committee chairpersons and vice chairpersons. When I was covering that, he even had enough power to order the police that come in and remove the delegates from meetings they were having in the legislative offices. He had the locks changed on the council chambers so many times, it was getting silly. The council ended up having to meet over in the education building at one point. And it was then that the council decided that if there was going to be any fairness in what was going to be happening with these federal charges and any true investigation, there had to be a way to do that. And that's where they created the special prosecutor. Because Chairman, even though they were able to remove or put Chairman McDonald on administrative leave, they still had to deal with his political appointee. And people understand that there was a huge amount of pressure put on the council at that time because they were pretty much the police department was headed, the police chief was a political appointee. So the police were listening to, whatever Chairman McDonald wanted, and at that time it was Vice Chairman Johnny R. Thompson, and he was still there. And so the police were pretty much allowing an abuse of the council delegates. And I watched as some of the council delegates were getting their hair pulled. People were throwing rocks at them, spitting on them. And the police were turning their backs. And the ones that did speak up and were trying to protect the council, they eventually were fired or put on leave and put under investigation. So there was a lot that was happening, even within the Division of Finance, where checks were being issued. That was being held up. There was a lot of, there was no payments weren't being made out to the council, to other things within the legislative branch. But when they finally were able to remove Chairman McDonald, they realized that they could not have a fair investigation of the charges brought against him. That's when they said, we're going to have a law, which will be for the special prosecutor, and this law will only be to elected officials, high-ranking elected officials also, and political appointees.
So that's how the special prosecutor's office came into being.
Yeah, and then they said, okay, now we have this law for our special prosecutor. Now we need to have the process they gave to the judicial branch. They said, we need to give it to an independent, unbiased group, and we will give it to the court because they are the ones that deal with those legal issues and fairness. And so they said that their window rock, the courts would be the ones that would select the special prosecutor. Once there was just cause for a special prosecutor, the next step would be that it would immediately go into the judicial branch, for it was out of the hands of the executive branch and the legislative branch, which was the president and vice president and the council. So the special prosecutor is in the judicial branch. So if anyone wants to criticize the special prosecutor, they also need to criticize the judicial branch. The judicial branch is the one that accepts, that issues a request for proposal. And then these different law firms or individual attorneys come forward and present their proposal, and the judicial branch will decide which one to select. The first one that they selected was Fallerin in this whole issue dealing with the council that started with ONSTAT and BCDS, which is where the council felt that President Shirley was very close in negotiating those contracts. And so they felt that there might have been something illegal happening. And it's true, all of that happened in the executive branch, under the Division of Economic Development. Those contracts were made with ONSTAT and with CCDS. And then the council decided that they were going to remove President Shirley because of those allegations. But there was not any allegations at that point, but there was a huge amount of questions. And they did not properly allow the president come forward and explain why he should be placed on administrative leave. Were these charges at a point where he should have been on administrative leave? And that was not proven. It wasn't done. And so that's when the courts got involved. And the court said, no, you did not allow President Shirley due process, and all of these other rights were violated, and they put President Shirley back in. And at that same time that was happening, she was moving forward with the initiative to reduce the ADA to 24. That the reduction of the council delegate from 88 to 24, there's been, I mean, reducing it to half even, you know, that those numbers have been kicked around for a long time, but there has been that from the people to reduce the council, and President Shirley led that. And then what happened also during that time that was happening is I received documents from the Office of the Controller. And that's the only place that these documents could come from, because that's where the financial information management, the financial management information system is. It's a huge computer where all money comes in, checks are cut, I mean, and people's names, everything is in there. Amounts, you know, dates, everything. That FMIS is like this huge bank. And the controller is the head of that. And that continues to be Mark Grant. But those documents show that council delegates and even some council staff were receiving huge amounts of money from the discretionary fund. And I immediately knew that that was wrong, because the discretionary funds were for constituents that had the most need. Elders, students, single parents, people that needed burial assistance. Not council delegates. They were not allowed to have that. And so that was the pressure from the people is what push that question to the special prosecutors or to the attorney general, who at that time was Louis Annette Soucy, because that's the first step in handing an investigation to the special prosecutor. And Attorney General Annette Soucy reviewed everything and said, there's enough here that warrants an investigation from the special prosecutor, and since we already have a special prosecutor, this is going to be part of the investigation. And they gave that to the special prosecutor.
How much was the total contract for to hire a special prosecutor?
The special prosecutor, there's a contract amount that is provided. And if additional funds are needed, the special prosecutor goes back to the judicial branch. That question has been asked of the judicial branch. And as far as I know, I haven't seen the exact amount for it. But see, you have to understand that the special prosecutor was hired to investigate ONSTAT and BCDS and the ties to President Shirley. And then the council discretionary funds were added to that investigation. So it's like you're hired to do this project. You bid for it, and you say, oh, it's going to take me this much money to do your project, and they say, okay. And then out of the blue, they come and say, okay, we're adding this to the project. So you're going to immediately say, well, is there additional funding? Because now there's additional work that I have to do. And so in doing that, that again goes back to the judicial branch, because they said, okay, you got to do the council. And then the council turned around and said, well, we're not the only ones that get discretionary funds. The president and the vice president also get discretionary funds, so they should be made a part of this investigation. So then that was added to the special investigator. And then... But that wasn't it. So then the issue over tribal ranches came up also. and I was doing an investigation of what was happening with tribal ranchers and the money, and it just came from the ranchers themselves. And this and all of my stories come from the people. They call me, they fax information, they drop off stuff in, you know, plain brown envelopes. I used to walk into my office and there'd be papers there. It's like, well, what is this? And I'd open it up and there's documents. The people are seeing wrongdoing. They know it's wrong and they want something done. And that's what happened with the tribal ranches. So I started investigating what was happening with the tribal ranches, and it involved elected officials getting preferential treatment for their cattle. And you have a whole line, a whole list of people wanting to have an opportunity to lease a tribal ranch for their cattle, for their livestock. And yet, it's been known the elected official has gone to the top of the line. And so the pressure of the people also, that was added to the special prosecutor. And so you had one man who had come in to do one investigation being given the council discretionary fund, the president, the vice president discretionary fund, and then the tribal ranches. So you had four issues before the special prosecutor. So
wow. Is
it a matter of money, or is it a matter of, and who's the ones that are complaining about paying the special prosecutor? The ones that are being prosecuted. Do the people want to really see what's happening, or do they just want what's happening in, with the tribal funds to continue, and even tribal ranches, which is tribal property, tribal vehicles, tribal planes? Laws are not applied fairly to elected officials across the board. You have some chapter officials who are facing, that have violated the law, and they're being told, you know, you have to pay this money back, and you can't run for office, and you have been found guilty. That's it. Out of here. President Shirley, when he was with Vice President Daish, was found guilty of violating the ethics law. But the ethics director at that time, who now heads the Division of General Services, found a loophole for President Shirley and Daish to get through, which allowed them to apologize and pay back, or just apologize, actually. And they continued on. And that same thing happened with President Shelley and Vice President Rex Lee Jim. They made a deal, and they're supposed to pay back restitution. So the question is, are they guilty? It's like what I did about the special prosecutor. Technically, those charges have not been dismissed against President Shelley. I mean, against former President Shirley. Technically, Shelley and Jim are not guilty, but yet, yeah, they were able to make a settlement in which they said, okay, we'll pay back the money. I mean, how can someone pay back money if it wasn't taken, if it wasn't theirs? I mean, I don't understand that rationale. Do you, Cal? I don't understand it.
Well, that's the same question as the, where, you know, the other one. I was just reading in an article written by Felicia Fonseca. In there, it's talking about Edmund Yazzie, our council delegate, and that he had cut a deal. And the interesting thing about that whole thing is this, and this is what, why that I'm wondering, I mean, is this about ethics or is this about money? Is this about the right thing to do or is this about getting our money back? Is this the the precedents that we want to set. These are a lot of the, there's the technical part of it, and then there's also the emotional or the conscious or the psychological side of all of these issues, the need for the special prosecutor, whether the money's being paid back. It seems to me that we're all over the place. There's not one thing. Like, for instance, back to Edmund Yazzie. Edmund Yazzie, I mean, let me just say this. I don't have anything against revivals. You know, I don't mean that as a funny thing, but so I don't want to get the, you know, any of the religious groups saying that I'm making fun of them. I'm not making fun of them. It just was that we needed to go in there and clarify, you know, are we in Navajo culture or are we, you know, Christianity? So I love all churches. So let me just state that clear. But anyway, back to Edmund Yazzie. Edmund Yazzie cut a deal. But here's the thing. The reality is this, is the Navajo Nation, which is basically the people hired a special prosecutor. Whatever President Shelley, whatever council delegate, whatever Chief Justice or and so forth, every government official is, quote, is really the Navajo people. Therefore, we hired a special prosecutor using our money to be able to prosecute public monies that were allegedly misused. Now we're having a shootout between executive and legislative. But now a deal is cut. And here's another thing too, is that how can a public prosecution, public matter, become a private matter? What bothered me about that whole thing is that why are we prosecuting if we can't even find out what happened to our money? Was it taken or not taken? Why is it now a confidential thing? Okay? I'm not saying there's something wrong, that any of these guys did anything wrong. I'm saying that the special prosecutor, if you're going to go out there and prosecute, make sure that you're giving recommendation that's going to make sense in the long run. But why is it now that you're cutting deals between an official who's public? Now, if this was a private matter, that's another story. You know, they can say that that's confidential, and that's true. I don't care to know what, you know, so-and-so's private deal is, but this is about a public matter. And so that was really the part that really kind of was stuck out in my mind.
You know, the what happened is that in the former council's attempt in 1989, in their attempt to try to make sure that the special prosecutor would be independent, and therefore they put it within the judicial branch. What they didn't realize back then, I think, was that there would still be a way to slow down those wheels, the special prosecutor. Because the council is the one that holds the purse strings. The judicial branch has to go to the council and justify their budget. Even the executive branch, headed by president, whoever the president is, in this case it's Shelley, has to go to the council and justify their budget. And Speaker Nays, who heads the legislative branch, goes to the council and justifies his budget, which is basically the council budget. So how fair is that? And when you talk about, you know, what is not public and what is being hidden, and the concern over how much is being spent on the special prosecutor, you have to look seriously at what is being spent by the legislative branch, the office of the speaker. The office of the speaker is the one that also controls the purse strings for the council and the delegates. And there was an allegation made by one of the delegates, Alton Shepard, that as soon as he had his legislation introduced to remove Speaker Nays, that there were payments being made to council delegates. And these payments can actually be justified by, oh, yeah, we're going to let your committee have a special meeting. Oh, yeah, your committee can go travel to Las Vegas or Washington, D.C. Or your committee can, or, you know, oh, yeah, you have your tribal credit card. I have to approve all of your expenditures. I'm not going to even look at what you bought. I'm just going to sign off on it, send it over to the Office of the Controller. There's an allegation right now from a former government development commissioner who found out that the director of the government development office used some of his of the commission's budget for Speaker Nays. They transferred those funds over to the office of the speaker. And some of those allegations have gone to the ethics office as complaints. There's an ethics complaint against Speaker Nays that has been sitting in the ethics and rules office since this past summer. I ask about it every time I run into the director. Well, what's happening with it? And the latest one was he went before Law and Order, and then I went outside to interview him, and he said, oh, that's still under investigation. But you have to seriously look at who gets funding and who doesn't. The ethics office gets its funding from Speaker Nays, and they've been asking for additional investigators to investigate all these ethics complaints that have come into them. They have hundreds of ethics complaints that are just sitting there because they don't have the investigators to go out and investigate, which is part of due process. And I understand that.
Right.
And so you have all these laws that are in place to protect the people's money, the people's buildings, equipment, you know, keep the elected officials walking the straight and narrow, but if there's no one to help do that, then we find ourselves in this huge mess.
Is the question about the balance of power, what is it? I think it goes back, okay, no matter what the circumstances, who hired who, for what reason, I think, doesn't it appear that it goes back to the original, quote, special prosecutor, the need for a special prosecutor? And you go back to 1989, you just basically covered all of that. There was a document that was developed at the time that enabled the Navajo Nation Council to exercise its power. And so, having said that, we fast forward to today. And so here we are. Why do you think the council got reduced from 88 to 24? What was the real reason why?
Marty. It was because of what happened with the discretionary fund. The people want an honest government. And it boils down to when you go purchase anything, you want to purchase something that you are going to get your money's worth. When you cast your ballot, that's what you're casting. You are putting your trust which has no, you just kind of put a price tag on anyone's trust. You're putting that into your elected officials to make good decisions for you. And here on the reservation, and I think anywhere, there's a huge amount of hardship. People don't have time to be watching and following around their elected official to make sure that they're not putting money in their pocket or putting money in their relative's pocket or having an affair and just not being moral, not living by the standards of a Diné leader. What we've always had. And so when they see what is happening and they read it in the newspaper, they respond. The people are concerned. You ask anyone if they want an honest government, and they're going to say yes. You ask them, do you want to have an honest deal? You know, do you want to make sure that that vehicle is going to work when you hand over your money to me? They're going to say yes. As business people, you're a business person. You don't want to go into business with someone that can, you know, walk off with your money and has a history or even, you know, any kind of dark cloud hanging over them. Because you have worked hard for your money. And you're not about to throw it away. And the people have said this over and over, and that's why I said, you know, this referendum to give that power back to the people is because the people want an honest government. They felt that maybe if they trimmed down the council from 88 to 24, it would be a lot easier to watch. But the council has found ways, or some of them actually, not all of them, have found ways to get around letting the people know what they do. And one of them is, I get worn out trying to figure out where the council is meeting and what committees are meeting where when they should be meeting over here. I just got a little announcement that the Resources and Development Committee, which is chaired by Delegate Catherine Benally, got approval from Speaker Nays to go have a meeting in Tohatchule. And the only item on their agenda, they only have one resolution on their agenda. And it's for a land purchase, not anywhile near Tohatchule. It's on the other side of the reservation. It's in Coconino County. So why are they meeting in Tohatchule on a land purchase that's happening in Flagstaff?
Oh, boy. Wow.
And that's a special committee meeting. They've already had their regular committee meeting. And who can afford
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the thing is this, is that, you know, I kind of want to get back to the, you know, to me, whatever the case is, whatever the dynamics of this whole, whatever angle, whether it's judicial, executive, or legislative, you know, we're talking about the Navajo Nation government, and that is that, okay, right now, the here and now is that we have a special prosecutor, and that special prosecutor is investigating, dropping charges here, they're making deals, whatever the case is. Now, to me, it appears Title II needs to be revisited because, if I'm not exactly right, correct me on this, and that is that Title II was set up just specifically for that time to be able to empower the Navajo Nation Council. And that has never been changed. That's why that today it almost appears, I might be wrong on this thing, and I don't have a problem being, you know, corrected on that, and that is that the power still remains with the council, and that's being unrelented. So technically, if the Navajo people want a real balanced three-branch government right now, it appears like it's not. I might be wrong on this, like I said. And so therefore, shouldn't Title 2, which is, in my opinion, is a temporary law. Shouldn't that be made permanent somehow, somewhere? Or was that the attempt to, by this referendum discussion, that was that, well, we need to give power back to the people? Okay, so does that mean, how does that exactly now tie together? Shouldn't it be Title II changed so that we can have a 3-branch government so that the power is balanced? And, of course, there's the other side of dynamics, too, is that it goes back to the executive branch having too much power. So, but now, back then it was chairman. Today it's the president. What's your thoughts on that?
Title II was created to separate the legislative branch from the executive branch. Because of what I said about the council over the years delegating a lot, I mean most of their powers to Chairman McDonald. And they learned the hard way when they tried to place Chairman McDonald administrative leave, how much power he really had. I don't think anyone knew. I didn't really understand it either until that happened. And in that, they said that it would be something temporary. And the council at that time recognized that they should not be the ones to tell the people, this is how your government is going to look. They really wanted to involve the people, and they said, let us give this, and rightfully so, they said, back to the people. They're the ones that should decide what their government looks like and how it's going to work for them. And that way, they're going to be involved in this government process. And we're going to get as many of them, you know, in any way possible together. And that's when you had the Government Development Office created. And so they had this huge summit in 2009, and they came out with all of these recommendations on how the government should look. They had chapter officials there. They had former elected officials there. They had organizations. They had different groups there. They had just community people come in. And they all sat and talked and discussed at length all of these issues, the pros and cons, and decided by consensus that these are the changes they wanted. And it went back, and it went to the council, which was a new council, and that council nitpicked it until the people gave up that were presenting it from the Government Development Office. And now you have this council criticizing the Government Development Office and saying, they haven't done anything. We're just giving them money and they're not doing anything. Let's just get rid of that office and we'll do it ourselves. And this legislation that came before them, the referendum, that's what people don't understand, and that's not what's being taught in our schools or even taught to the people. There's no place where they can pick up their history to help them remember what their government looked like before the federal government brought this clone over here. And that's what's created this mess. It's created a lot of disharmony. It's created a lot of disrespect. And within the NEG government, there was that harmony and respect for everyone's voice. And that's what people have to understand, is what our government really looked like and why it worked so well. And that there were so many concepts in there that dealt with ethics, that dealt with honor, with value. And so when you talk about this balance of power, we had that. But it was taken away because Uncle Sam was in bed with corporate America and still continues to be. And did not have heart for the people, did not have heart for us. What they wanted was our natural resources, and they continue to want that. So we still have our elected officials talking about, the most recent one is the Navajo Nation Gaming Compact, which has gone before the New Mexico legislature. And President Shelley says, hey, New Mexico legislature, you have to approve this gaming compact because it's going to provide jobs and revenues for our people. And under, when Shelley was vice president to Shirley, the unemployment rate was what it's right now, between 55 and 60%. And we even have supposedly less money. But we need 5 casinos. And 5 casinos will, I don't know what, miraculously end unemployment.
Wow. So now, one part that I was kind of interesting to me, what you said, there are tribal ranches. Where are these tribal ranches located at?
They're located mainly in eastern Navajo, but there are some that are also located in Arizona around the Loop area. And actually, I hate dividing up our recognizing those state boundaries, but they're across the reservation. And these, they're tribal ranches because the land that the tribe was not allocated, you know, became allotted land, or, you know, went under any local government jurisdiction of the reservation chapters, or were grazing permits, under grazing permits. And way back when, the council created these ranches saying, you know, maybe there's people out there that don't have grazing permits, whose family never got a grazing permit, but they should be allowed, if they want to be livestock owners, to have a place for their livestock, and that's why they were set aside. And every year, they're supposed to be reviewed. The Agriculture Department, which has a tribal ranch program, which is under the Division of Natural Resources, they have people that go out and look at the ranches to see how, you know, if there's proper livestock management and land management, range management. And also, you know, they're supposed to be taking care of the windmills and the water. And so people can come in, and Navajo people, and if there's a ranch that's available, they have a long list, a huge list. They can apply for a tribal ranch. And a couple of years ago, after this investigation that I did, they revamped that whole tribal ranch process and decided that there needed to be a way to open it up to other ranch, other Navajo people, to be given an opportunity to go in. And so now that new, it's done by another process, closed bidding, and they have a group that comes in and looks at the at proposals from individuals on how they're going to. They have to have a livestock plan, a ranch management plan, and so you have actually you have a lot of younger ranchers coming in that have business backgrounds. Now there are some of them that are doing that, and then you still have some that have carried on their ranching from years and years ago. But under the former tribal ranch manager, the elected officials, I found that elected officials were getting favorable treatment for their relatives and friends and even for themselves. So it seems to be a more fair distribution of tribal ranches. And the Big Bokeas is an area where they have, you know, they're opening up for ranching. The Flagstaff area, the Peaks Ranch. And out in the new lands, they have, they organize the ranchers out there into a cooperative. And so they're the ones that are the most successful, it seems.
Well, so back to the Navajo Nation government, you know, it's quite interesting to me that a lot of these, how much do you think these charges that are surfacing today or, you know, in the recent time or just now, how much do you suppose that that's all related to the upcoming elections?
The misuse, the allegations of the criminal charges related to the discretionary funds, those occurred in 2006. And they're finally coming to light. And it's really difficult because people are now, you know, out of everything that's negative, there's something positive that comes. And out of what's happening over these charges, criminal charges, and especially since they were filed against Speaker Nays, it's really brought focus on what's happening with elected officials and misuse of tribal money when there's a real need for it to provide direct services to the people. And I want to say one thing, too, is that over the years in being at these annual budget sessions, the council and whatever chairman is there, or even the president, they have cut at the school clothing program. The cuts that are made are to programs for the people. And the programs that aren't watched are the ones that are supposed to be for the people. There's a real need for child care services. And yet you have a council delegate whose wife operates a child care program that repeatedly gets funding. Her program is good, but there should be an equal distribution of those funds. And unless you're here, you don't see that. And so when you're talking about how this is going to impact the upcoming election, I thought that it would impact the election 4 years ago. And yet you had 16 delegates that were facing charges related to the discretionary fund reelected.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. It really is. We have a caller on the phone. I don't know if they want to just call in and listen in like some people do. There's a lot of people who just request us to listen in. I guess that's the only access that they have. So, again, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation. This is Cal Nez, and I appreciate all of you listeners out there and people who are calling in. And if you have any questions or comment, please give us a call. Telephone number here is 347-989-0048. And I really do appreciate Marty Shabala for her insight on all of the history, literally, of the Navajo Nation government. I mean, I think that, you know, of course, this goes way back, and I think that we will get into all of those other discussions, how things were, how things could be, and how things can be, all of those things. But, Marty, I really, really do appreciate that. So we have a caller. Caller, can you hear me? Hello, you're on the phone, 505-258. Hello. I guess they just want to listen in or something. Well, they just actually hung up. So, but anyway, well, you know, 7 years, we've been sitting here going back and forth on this. So, Marley, where do we end up with this in the end? What's the win-win, if there's such a thing as a win-win?
Well, it has to be the people themselves. I mean, I can write about what's happening in the council, what the discussions are, you know, and what chapters are doing, but it's up to the people to get out and vote, to say with their vote what kind of government they want. And that's what I tell people, you know, when they start complaining about the council or the president or the vice president or a political appointee, it's like, well, you know, those individuals just didn't walk into the president's office and sit down and declare themselves president or walk into the council and declare themselves delegates. They were elected by the people. So it's the people that's deciding, like I said, you know. 16 delegates were re-elected from the former 88. And so what does that say about us? And then we have, but actually you have to look at the numbers. And there's always low voter turnout. And I don't know if the voter turnout dropped 4 years ago or if it increased. Have we decided in our own way, which is in the Dene way, not to take part in our government and say, we're gonna voice our opinion by not taking part? But if you do that, we're allowing it to happen, because this government, if it was our other government, if it really was our Dene government, that would work. And there's little things that are there that allow the people to say that. They can go to their chapter and pass a resolution, and there's a law that allows that for the chapter to pass a resolution of no confidence in the government, or no confidence in the Division of Economic Development, or no confidence in the Attorney General. And they speak out in that way, but that's about it. To make any real changes, it's going to have to be done with people that, with an elected or with a candidate that the people will question and not sit back and listen to and have a handout. And this individual will say, you know, and I see it. I watch candidates, and they'll say, well, you know, I can bring you jobs. I can put money in out there. You know, I'll do this for you. I'll do that for you. The people need to stop wanting someone to do something for them and tell that person, this is what we want you to do for all of us, for everybody, for everything here in our home. We have to remember that Dene thinking of home. What is home? Remember the children, the grandchildren, those babies, the ones that are not yet born, planning for them. How many of us, you know, you have children, I have children, I have grandchildren. I plan for them. I want, you know, a good life for them. And I want them to work hard, though. I'm not going to give them things, because then that's not going to help them work hard. They're not going to... They won't know how to earn and have a life. You know, life is harsh. So it goes back to the voters. And one community that is coming forward, stepping forward, and it has to do with Chippewa Chapter President Dwayne Chiliazzi, who was part of the 49ers, who were the ones that stepped forward and said, we need to do something about what's happening with our chairman. He's facing these serious federal charges. And now he's at the Shiprock chapter. And on Monday, they passed a resolution. And their recommendation is that the Navajo Council place members who are criminally charged, put them on administrative leave without pay until they are exonerated or are found guilty by the Navajo judicial system. And their reason for it is that the Diné people require their leadership to obey all laws of the Navajo Nation, including fundamental laws of the Diné, the Navajo ethics law, and to uphold the oath of office they swore to. And the Shiprock community has also said that Navajo elected officials are held to a higher standard of conduct, to be above reproach, to be honorable, and to set an example for all Navajo people, in particular the young.
Well, didn't I also hear from one of the council delegates on the council floor or somewhere saying that there's at least maybe two or three, I think that's maybe coming from David Tom, two or three chapters who are also against any removal?
You know, I've asked for those resolutions, and I haven't seen them. There was one resolution, but under the Navajo law, chapters are required to have a quorum of 25. There are a few chapters that have reduced their quorum because they can't even get a quorum of 25. I mean, you also have to look at that, too, that the Navajo people are, they don't want to be involved in government. I think they really feel like they really don't know what to do. And they don't know what to do because, and it's sad to say, but for 28 years, like I said, I get documents left on my desk anonymously. And when I do try to get documents from the legislative branch or the office of the president or the executive branch, I get all kinds of excuses, and these are public documents. I asked Speaker Nays the other morning when he held a meeting over at the Quality Inn after the council didn't get enough votes to remove him. I asked him, I said, you still have not provided me the Navajo law that says you can meet over here, and if this meeting is illegal, are you going to pay these council delegates that were here the $300 stipend that you've been paying them to pass? And isn't that illegal use of the people's money? He told me to go talk to this public information officer because the question was, quote, too hard for him. He laughed at me.
Wow. You know, that's one of the interesting things about, you know, is that, you know, I've worked with the state government, city governments here in Salt Lake, as well as the tribal governments, not only just the Navajo Nation, but other tribes. We have the Goshutes, the Paiutes, we've got the Northern Shoshone. And they all have their different setup on their governments. But all in all, I think the state government, any government that I've worked with who is here in the state of Utah, not to sound like I'm throwing kudos on their behalf, but just for the point of discussion, and that is that their first item that they say is that we have got to have transparency. We have got to do everything we can to make sure that the general public and the people that we represent get the first heads up on every issue that's going down the pike. And there, in a lot of cases, you know, with a little, a few exception, but overall, I think the news media is one of their best friends. They try to hold press conferences, issue press releases, they get together for luncheons and so forth, things like that. You would think that that's kind of a philosophy the Navajo Nation government should take. I mean, the news, if they want to get, speaking about being popular, wouldn't you think that they want to be the news people's best buddies?
I would think so. I really would. I when they have a press conference, I'll go to their press conference and do a story on it. And I attend their meetings. And if you read my blog, I'm putting down what all of them are saying. You know, I'm not editing it or anything. You know, whatever is coming out of their mouth, I'm typing and writing. And so I'm covering whatever they're doing. And then, so I'll ask, you know, after the meeting, can I have a copy of the legislation that you were discussing? Or can I have a copy of the vote? You know, and, or a report that was presented. The decentralization report that was presented yesterday before the Joint Committees of the Resources and Development Committee and Budget and Finance Committee, I had to beg and beg and beg, and finally I got it from one of the delegates. The legislative staff is like they're afraid to give me anything because if they do, something could happen to them. I don't know why.
Yeah, Marty, what would you do to them?
I mean, not me. I mean, I was like, you know, if they hand me a piece of, I don't know. But their boss is Speaker Nays, and, you know, he could be a bit upset with me for writing the truth, you know. But the people, that's
yeah.
What I mean. I think that I really feel, and that's why I do what I do. My complete focus is reporting on the Navajo government. The people have a right to know what their elected officials are doing in their name. And when I say what they're doing in their name, I mean it. I have a lot of con people, other reporters for other tribes, and it really makes me sad because we have become a laughing stock in Indian country. And our relatives along the Rio Grande and even the Apaches are angry at us because our president, President Shelley, told them that the Navajo Nation Gaming Compact should be approved and should not be subjected to the same treatment that New Mexico treats the Pueblos and the Apaches, because we're the biggest tribe. We have the biggest land base. That's terrible. I mean, it's like flaunting that. And that's so disrespectful, and they're doing that in my name, your name.
All the listeners' names.
Yeah.
You know, there's which really brings up another thought, and that is that as elected leaders, you know, there's, you know, you're looking in from the outside. You know, it's really interesting to me how that there's different perspective of people who live on the Navajo Nation, people who live off the reservation. And so when you're looking, really, in reality, I think that for all leaders, I think they've got to be conscientious, and for all upcoming elected leaders, you know, they've got to begin to think more on a global basis rather than just what's really going to affect the Navajo Nation. And I think most of the messages, just like you said, is that, okay, here's promises to... There are promises, all sorts of things, and those, you know, and I think that speaking, you know, those are some of the political discussions. I mean, they're kind of like the standard cut, the political speeches. And so now, as we're moving forward, I think that when we're talking about it, I think that most, rather than having these standardized political speeches, I think there's got to be, what do we say while we're going into office? These are the things that we're going to uphold you to. These are the standards that are what we expect of all the candidates. We're not just going to just settle for what's given to us. We've got to take an initiative. We've got to take a very proactive role to demand what we really want for our elected leaders. And so, while we're talking about language, the Native Americans, I mean, you know, like if you look at it, if you look at it from the federal level, there's the majority and then there's the minority, and there's literally a federal law that basically says we have these five recognized minority groups: Blacks, Hispanics, Pacific Islanders, Asians, and Native Americans, or Alaskan Natives. And so now the Navajo people were just one of the line item on that group. So therefore, when I was having my discussion last week from the Navajo, the Washington office, and this is the thing that I brought up, is that we've got the National Congress of American Indian. And so when we're having issues on a federal level, we've got to be able to begin, or at a state level, like in the case of which I'm getting to for New Mexico. And that is that while we're talking and engaging with non-natives, federal or state, we have got to be very sensitive into what words that we use, what positions that we use, because it not only just affects just the Navajo Nation, but as one of the line item community members of this Native American on a federal level. And so we can't just go out there and just be just not being sensitive to other tribes, even though that they might be, you know, 1,500 as far as their membership, but they still have a land base, they still have a voice, they still have a one-on-one relationship with the federal government, where in our case we have, you know, 350,000. And so, that might be one of the possibilities, some of the things that we ought to be talking about also in the future shows, and that is that what is our expectation of our, you know, political leaders. And so I do agree with that, and it's unfortunate that have offended some of our fellow tribes within New Mexico, not at the expense of the gaming, but it's quite interesting, so I'm glad you brought that up. So we've got 5 minutes. Marley, if you want to just kind of close it down, see what we got to say, and get us prepared for next week, and then I'll finish up the show. And again, you're listening to Politics on the Navajo Nation, 347-989-0048. If you have a question, just quick say hello, but that's next week's show. But anyway, Marley, you got something to share with us for the last few minutes here?
See, one thing that's being discussed right now, which involves, well, everything we discuss involves everyone, but there's this movement of decentralization, which is a report that the council asked for. Well, actually, it came from the Budget and Finance Committee, and they provided about $3 million for it. And it's to take some of the services from Window Rock out to the communities and set up these regional centers. And at these regional centers, they're going to provide an attorney and an accountant. And there's pros and cons to both of those, but looking at the audits of chapters, they certainly need accountants and attorneys, because you and I know as business people, when you go into a contract, and if you're not familiar with the individual that you're going to meet, this, enter into this contract with, and they might be at a higher level than you legally with contracts, and they might even have an attorney, you know, you feel a bit, you can feel a bit intimidated. And so they're going to have attorneys that are going to try to help chapters that want to go into contracts, those that are certified and even those that are not certified. So that's moving forward. And some criticism of it is that, you know, it's coming too late in the game, and it's true. I mean, what, 9 more months and then you get a new council and a new president and vice president? But that's an issue. And then people need to go to the Navajo Council website, keep updated on what's going on. You know, I don't know what's happening with the Office of the President and the Vice President. You need press releases. But people need to start telling the government to open itself up and to just quit saying that, you know, they support transparency. I don't think they – I'd like to get a definition of transparency from the Navajo government.
Okay. All right, Marley. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And again, this is Marley Shabala, and thank you, Marley, for filling in for Mike Colonna, who I had scheduled, and he was supposed to be on tonight's show to talk about the land issues, land summit, land whatever that's called, and to kind of get a up-to-date information exactly what that is. And I'm sure that's a whole discussion, because it is going to affect the Navajo Nation grazing permit. And Marty, how do we have about 2 minutes left. How much, where do people get in contact with you? What's your contact information? Give us all your business information.
Okay. Well, people can just Google my name, Marley Shabala, and the first name is spelled M-A-R-L-E-Y, and last name is Shabala, S-H-E-B, as in boy, A-L-A, and then just Marley Shabala's notebook, and my website will pop up. And I do on-the-spot reporting from all of the Navajo government meetings, wherever they're at, and their press conferences. And I also try to get to other events that people call me about and want some write-ups on. And so, like I said, a couple of days ago, I was out at Fort Defiance. The high school opened up a new sports complex, which is just beautiful. And there's a lot of positive things happening on our reservation. And I just want everyone to appreciate our life here on the reservation, where we are able to be, and we should all take care of it, all of it.
Yeah. All right. That's a very good thought, Marley, and I appreciate it. And we'll have you call in again. You bring some very, very powerful insight on this, and I really do appreciate it. And I'm sure there's people out there listening. Again, I am so proud of you, Marley, that you have started your business. I mean, I think that's just incredible. You're showing us the way, and let's keep going. And so, ladies and gentlemen, again, thank you for listening. This was Politics on the Navajo Nation, the world voice on Navajo politics. Next week.
Online, on air. 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 Online, on air.
Politics on the Navajo Nation.
On the Navajo. Online, on air. Online, on air. Politics on the Navajo Nation.
Politics on the Navajo Nation.
Hi, my name is Dylan. You are listening to Internet Radio.